This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Program of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is October 5th, 2009. This is a continuation of the first session with Professor Doug Bates of the Department of Statistics. So Doug, we wanted to pick it up now with asking you of your observations of when you got here in the fall of 1980 to begin your position with the department. What was the department like? Who were the key figures here? What were you expected to do? You've already made reference to when you were at Queens that statistics here was like Mecca.
Yes.
So maybe you could give us a sense of what you found when you actually came here to work.
Well, when I came here in 1980, I had a split appointment. We had a statistical consulting service, which was directed by Brian Joyner. And Brian was another formative influence in the department. He later went on to create a company here in Madison, Joyner Associates, which was a very successful consulting firm and software company. He worked with a project in Penn State before he came here on creating a statistical package called Minitab. So there was a lot of experience with computing and a lot of experience in consulting, and especially in areas there had been a group working here on chemical kinetics. George Box, who founded the department, had a background in the chemical industry. Bill Hunter, who was the first PhD graduate of the department and stayed on at the faculty in the department. His original background was in chemical engineering. Oh. Stu Hunter, who was also on the faculty, he had originally worked in chemical engineering. One of the best-selling books in statistics called Statistics for Experimenters, written by Box, Hunter, and Hunter, was based upon their experiences here. Norman Draper, very well known for his work in applied regression analysis. He had some background and some contacts with engineering. And then there were people like Bob Miller, who were working with time series analysis, areas in finance and business. Grace Waba has always been a very creative force in the department, and she was very well established here. So there was a lot of people who were, leaders in the field. I would say that the area of statistics for physical and engineering, physical sciences and engineering, was particularly well established here because of the influence of George Box. There was a journal called Technometrics. So there's various areas that end with metrics in them. I think that Technometrics was pretty much the ideas for the need for such a journal and getting it going had originated here at the Department of Statistics. And one of the other contacts that I'd had with this department, there's a series of conferences that are held in New England called the Gordon Conferences, and they all have something to do with chemistry. So there was a conference there on chemistry, statistics and chemistry and chemical engineering. And many of the people there had, at some point, their careers had touched on the University of Wisconsin-Madison Statistics Department. So that's why I said it's very formative for the ideas in that area. So I came here with wonderful expectation of the areas of application, the openness to ideas, the ability to talk about these kinds of applications. Also, the just the idea that one could do consulting work and have that considered as, you know, an academic activity. I had been working within a department of mathematics, and so of course the coin of the realm was abstract papers in mathematics journals, and
right.
You know, even applications would be kind of
suspect,
and certainly, you know, consultation you know, why in the world would one want to do that sort of thing? Whereas here, you know, there was a broad range. It was recognized that there's a broad range of activities that a statistician could be productively engaged in. One of the things that was really a shock for me when we did arrive here, though, I had not really inquired too deeply about the computing facilities, and I was quite taken aback because I'd come from rather sophisticated computing facilities.
At Alberta?
At Queen's and then later at Alberta. I mentioned that Alberta was the place where they had a lot of oil and natural gas revenue. It happens the way that the Canadian system is set up, that the royalties on that go to the provincial government and not to the federal government.
Oh.
So the provincial government in Alberta was quite wealthy. They didn't have a provincial income tax. They were able to support a lot of different projects at levels that would not have been possible other places in the country. And one of the things that they did spend money on was computers. They had very good computing facilities at the University of Alberta. And when I came here, I began to teach a course in statistical computing, somewhat ironic, and that ever since that class that I'd had when I was a freshman in college, I had never really studied computing formally. I just sort of picked it up along the way. Not unusual, really, for that period in history. And I began to explain things, you know, different techniques, and then found out that the computing facilities here were not up to that, which really shocked me. Yeah. At that time, what is now the Division of Information Technology was called the Madison Academic Computing Center, MACC.
Over on Dayton Street.
Right? Over on Dayton Street, yeah. And that's actually the building that the Department of Statistics was in and the Department of Computer Sciences. That building was initially more for the statistics department than for the computer science department. Computer scientists were just starting to organize into departments at those days when that building had been created. And actually the first director of the computing center was a student of statistics. So, early on, a lot of the use of the academic computing was for statistical analysis. You know, it was the only way to handle large data sets and to do that. So I had expected that there would be quite sophisticated computing facilities. And it happened that at that point, the university was sort of on the tail end of the technology, where, you know, a few years before it had been the leading edge, and by that time it had kind of fallen off. They chose to use UNIVAC computers, Most other places were using IBM, or when I'd been at the University of Alberta, Amdahl computers. Before that at Queen's, they were using Burroughs computers. The Burroughs were surprisingly sophisticated machines. And I don't think I would have gotten interested in computing without being exposed to them. And then here, the UNIVAC, in those days, when you made a commitment to a particular vendor for a computing system, you were really locked in for a long period of time just because it was such a large expenditure of money. They really hadn't progressed to nearly the same extent that the other vendors, and you know, the
UNIVAC
had not. So the university was kind of caught in that, as far as the academic computing went. And you know, some of the time it can help to be out on the edges of the technology. You know, the mainstream technology was IBM. You know, nobody ever got fired for recommending IBM, that sort of thing, but you just stayed with that. Well, that put you on the secure but sort of mundane path. You could go to the alternative vendors, but you risked going into a dead end. And it happened that where I'd been at Queen's, they went to one of the alternative vendors that had a very interesting development in computing and the approaches. UNIVAC didn't have the same ability to incorporate new ideas. And things got pretty stale. So here I'd been used to being able to work with very large data sets and very large amounts of memory and, you know, a lot of flexibility. The word that's used is virtual memory. And I described this in the first class that I was teaching on statistical computing, and people said, no, that's not available here, that you have, you know, a very limited amount of memory. And certainly, as we were talking about, the amounts of memory that you can have on, you know, even these small little cartridges now. In those days, you were not talking about gigabytes, and you were not talking about megabytes, you were talking about kilobytes. And that really has an effect upon your flexibility, upon what sorts of ideas that you can entertain, what sorts of approaches you can take. So I was quite taken aback by this. There were actually two systems. One was WITS, and I forget, the Wisconsin Interactive Terminal System or something like that, and then there was the UNIVAC. And neither of them were terribly advanced by any means. Fortunately, just at that point in time, so this would have been by about 1982, the development of smaller mini computers, it wasn't quite to the personal computer, microcomputer end of things, but the development of small mini computers came along. So I'm not sure, it was either in 1982 or 1983, the National Science Foundation started a program whereby departments in the mathematical sciences could apply for their own computing systems, to buy their own computing systems. And we were one of the first five programs. And this, you know, I was heading up this grant proposal for the department as an assistant professor. But it was very much self-interest. I needed these things to carry on the research that I was doing. And so we put together a proposal with very renowned, established researchers and this lowly assistant professor who was me, to get the money to buy a computer for the department. And we bought of Vax 11750, cost $250,000. Money from the University of Wisconsin, Wharf, Wisconsin Academic Research Foundation, Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation.
Right, so you got this through the graduate school.
You know, they had matching funds and money from the National Science Foundation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, of course, this was, as I say, $250,000. This a lot of money in those days, and you know, of course, the computing power in your typical cellular telephone is more powerful now, but it was a real big step forward for our department, and that was where a lot of the fact that we were sharing a building with the Department of Computer Sciences became very useful to us, in that they were already operating a certain number of computers of this sort.
Oh.
And so we were able to work out an arrangement whereby they were operating our computers as well as the computers for the Department of Computer Science. So they have a group that's called the Computer Systems Lab that was and is very sophisticated and carries out tremendous developments on the computer systems. They're maintaining, operating, providing availability to the computing resources at incredibly efficient financially. They're able to work with a lot of student assistants and project assistants to get very sophisticated computing facilities for very little money. And we were able to work out arrangements with them. I'd already had some contacts with that group. So that put us from being very far back in the field of the computing resources to really being right at the edge of the computing resources. And we could carry on a lot of research that otherwise would not have been possible.
Doug, at this point, are relations pretty good between statistics and computer science?
Yes, yeah. We've always had good relationships with the group that maintains this computer systems lab, the group that maintains and services the computing. And this was in no small part due to the director of that group, a man by the name of Paul Beebe, who really founded the group and is just a wonderful person to work with. And I love being around people who have great practical and intuitive senses. And, you know, he explained it. I can't guarantee that I'll know everything about the computer system, but if you show me once, I'll remember it. And, you know, it's like being around a really fine mechanic that, you know, they just know how to go about things like that. And he was also a great teacher. So, you know, he'd have to keep retraining a new group of students every year. But he did that and, you know, got them working for him, and they really did a great job. So that was really a turning point. I'd been feeling pretty isolated, actually, because I wanted to work in the statistical computing, which was an area that was just starting out at that time. And here I found that I didn't have the tools. And if you haven't been exposed to other methods, then you don't notice it. Right? It's only when you're coming from another kind of facility and you say, oh, I used to be able to do that and now I can't do this here. So that was actually quite a shock for me to encounter that. But, you know, we could overcome it. And then one of the things about the computer sciences department is that they were among the early adopters of the internet before it got called the internet. So there was something here that was called CSNet, And there were methods of doing, you know, communications between different computers that were running the Unix operating system, but the internet really hadn't occurred per se.
Was Larry Landweber
working? So Larry Landweber was involved with that. Mm-hmm. And that was very useful to us, or to me in particular, that I was around computer scientists who were quite sophisticated in their contacts and approaches. Again, I would say, you know, it's a marvelous opportunity to be in a city that feels like a small city, and to have all of the amenities of that, or not. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't get in a car and commute for a couple hours every day. I just get on my bicycle and ride down. And yet, to have access to the really cutting-edge kinds of facilities. And you know, I mentioned before the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundations. There's not too many places that you could go to and say, okay, we need matching funds to get this kind, and we need a commitment for the matching funds to get this kind of grant. And, mm-hmm. you know, here there was the mechanism to do that. So there's many of the aspects of the university that just encourage, you know, good work in a quiet kind of unassuming way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Doug, when you came that first year, mm-hmm. what else were you expected to teach?
Well, I was teaching the course on statistical computing, and I imagine at some point I taught introductory courses. I mean, almost throughout. You know, we have a lot of service courses, the courses in intro statistics for whatever. And, you know, that's what pays the salaries to a large extent. That's what is a large part of our department. We don't have a large undergraduate department, a large undergraduate program of majors in statistics. We have, you know, a few people, but not a big, that's not a big role for us.
Really?
We have a large graduate program.
But you do have some undergraduate majors every year?
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's grown over the years, but, you know, at the time that I came here, I don't even think we had any undergraduate majors. This is, again, the reflection of the fact that very few people start off their career saying, yeah, I'm going to be a statistician, you know, whereas they'll frequently come from, many people from a background in mathematics the way that I did, but other people from background in science or social sciences or, you know, many different ways that you can get into this idea that, oh, there's interesting questions to be answered about analysis of data. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm forgetting now exactly what your original question was.
Well, I was asking you what you were teaching.
Oh, what I was teaching, yes. So I would teach service courses at the undergraduate level. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we had specialized courses at the graduate level. Now, I had done my thesis work on these nonlinear models or nonlinear regression. And actually, George Box had the idea that for applied statistics in engineering, physical sciences, there would be an introductory undergraduate course and then a more advanced course, sort of at the higher undergraduate level, and then a graduate course. And so these were numbered 224 and 424 and 824. And the 424 was the course that was taught out of the book by Box Hunter and Hunter, which I mentioned before, is one of the best-selling books in statistics. And the graduate course was more on topics involving these nonlinear models and such. So I ended up teaching that. So I got to follow George Box into a course. Part of my appointment, as I mentioned before, was in the consulting laboratory. Mm-hmm. After a couple of years, we decided it would be better for me to go into the statistics department full time. It's hard, even in a place like this where you're where consulting is considered, you know, a reasonable activity for you to be doing. Some of the time, you end up being like the lawyer with the billable hours that you have to account for your time, and you have to charge it to this project and that project. And
right.
I'm actually more of an academic and less of a business person. Uh-huh. And so it ended up that a lot of my time was going on to one project, but that project was going to be finishing. It was to do with time of day electricity pricing.
Uh-huh.
It was early experiment to see whether you could influence people's usage of electricity by putting meters that would not only record the amount of electricity you used, but when you were using it,
mm-hmm.
so that you could try to convince people to use the electricity in the evening. Yeah, it's well known. You delay turning on the dishwasher until in the evening, so that when you're reheating the water,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't have to come at the peak usage times,
right.
in the around the dinner hour. But that project was coming to an end, and so there's a question of, so how are we going to be paying your salary after this?
Mm-hmm.
And my appointment per se was Department of Statistics. I was just sort of seconded to the consulting mm-hmm. laboratory, and so I went back to the Department of Statistics full time. And I would generally, over the years, I'll probably teach introductory, almost all the time I have at least one introductory course going on, and then perhaps a graduate level course or a late undergraduate special topics course. But I was doing the same
sort of thing. Doug, when you came, were you worried about the process of getting tenure?
Yes. Yeah.
I think
everyone would be.
And you know. Was the department helpful, or are you sort of left on your own?
Mm-hmm. I think there was less of a formal mechanism for mentoring young faculty or beginning faculty in
mm-hmm.
those days. So it was more informal, and you could know that some people thought what you were doing was fine, and perhaps others didn't think that it was quite up to snuff, and so it seemed to be more that you were navigating a series of personal relationships and not so much the departmental view. It has changed now that it is more formalized, that we do try to have mentoring committees and try to talk with untenured faculty members to say, well, you know, these are the expectations, and how's this going, and, you know, where's the teaching going, and that sort of stuff.
So what is, aside from your consulting in your
yeah.
first few years, what is your research program?
Well, it has touched on various areas of statistical computing.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much anything that I'm doing, I'm thinking of how would I calculate this? How would I evaluate this?
Mm-hmm.
But our department, George Box was very firm that he wanted to have both theory and applications.
He comes out of an application background, doesn't he?
Yes, yes. His initial work was, I always forget which acronym is which, I think it's Imperial Chemical Industries, so ICI. And I've recently been using an example from an early book that he contributed to. So there's a book called Statistics in Research and Production. It was edited by O.L. Davies, but George Box was one of the people who contributed to it. And the first edition of that book was published in 1947.
Wow.
And it's now in its fourth edition, but it was sort of the fundamental reference in the field for quite a long time. And at that time, George Box was working with the Dyestuffs division of ICI. This was a book that was internally produced at ICI and then,
uh-huh.
you know, was released to a wider audience. And so I've actually gone back to some of the earliest examples in there for the area that I'm currently working in.
Uh-huh.
And that's really enjoyable to revisit that because, you know, George is now 90 years old. He's going to be celebrating his 90th birthday later this month.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, formative influence across the field and especially on, you know, this type of thinking here, the sort of Madison School of Statistics. So there was always a feeling that, you know, you should be motivated by the practical question, but you should have the theoretical power to be able to handle it other than in an ad hoc method.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be able to have both the theoretical and the applications tools. So in my case, the other thing that I was bringing to it was this interest in the computing and ideas of the computational methods. There's many times that, you know, we can write down a formula, but that formula is not necessarily the best way to calculate things. And
mm-hmm.
so I not studied formally, but informally picked up a lot of the ideas in, you know, numerical linear algebra and related fields, optimization, and then a lot of practical experience as well. In just how could you expect to calculate these things and how could you do it quickly and accurately and reproducibly? And that's pretty much been the way that I've carried on.
It looks like you have a pretty extensive record of publications here.
Well, I don't really feel that I have that.
Oh, really?
That extensive a publication record. I have the inclination to perhaps over polish things, so I don't tend to be bringing out papers on a frequent basis.
Mm-hmm.
Tend to try to step back and synthesize and bring things together before necessarily doing the publication. For almost 10 years now, I've been working on a new approach or different approach to some of these classical ideas in statistics. I mentioned that I was using an example from George Box and ICI from way back in the 1940s. And they were concerned with situations where they would have different batches of material, and then they wanted to look at the variability of the yield or other characteristics within the batch and between the batches.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, you know, pretty much what statisticians do. You look at the variability, and it also comes through, you know, most recently I've been working with the Department of Public Instruction here at the state of Wisconsin, where now there's the requirement to have students in public schools tested every year on, here the name is the Wisconsin Knowledge and Concepts Examination. Generally this is mandated by the No Child Left Behind Act. And then you look at the scores of the students as they progress through their program and as they move between different schools and so forth. Well, it, you know, it may not seem on the surface that that's like the batch-to-batch and the within-batch variability, but it's getting at the same idea.
Mm-hmm.
You have different school districts, you have different schools, perhaps different classrooms. It happens in Wisconsin that they don't record the teacher, but and then you have the variability between the students. Plus you've got the trajectory over time, and you're interested in trying to separate out which sections of the variability come from the sort of selective aspects. There's other parts that are more reproducible in the sense that you're working with things that are sort of constant over time, like the differences between the males and the females.
Mm-hmm.
One item of interest is also racial disparity.
Mm-hmm.
You may look at whether or not the child qualifies for reduced cost lunches.
Mm-hmm.
So you have economic influences, gender-based, racial, ethnic categories.
Mm-hmm.
You have the time within their program, whether they're third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, and so forth. So there's a lot to come into that. And of course the difference is that when George was looking at these items, they had 5 observations on each batch. Well, here we've got 1.7 million observations over several years.
Mm-hmm.
So we're handling things in a very different scale, but underlying the ideas are very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been for a long time the ability to look at these models. But when you get into the millions of observations, you have to be very careful still how you do the computing. You can't waste a lot of cycles when you're doing that. So you have to, and again, I've been very fortunate that a person made a comment to me. It's like my saying, well, you can think of this in terms of the geometry of the situation. And then you think, yeah, that's a good idea. And I was teaching a short course here, and a person said to me, you know, somehow this, it feels to me like this should be related to sparse matrices.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, gee, I don't know anything about sparse matrices. And then for a while I went back and thought, maybe I should learn. You know, maybe there is something there. And through one of these things that can only happen now with the availability of the internet, I've exchanged a tremendous amount of information and talked, as it were, with one of the experts in the field. It was at the University of Florida. We've never been in the same room. We've never even spoken on the telephone, but we've sent a lot of email back and forth and asked questions and got responses and so forth. So then now I feel that I know fairly well what he's doing.
Yeah.
And you know, the other thing that's carried on most of my research program for now, verging on to 15 years or more, 25 years ago, I became very interested in some computing facilities that were being provided for statistics at Bell Laboratories. And Bell Laboratories was a marvelous place. It had this, it was the most academic place that I'd ever been to, and it wasn't a university. They just hired very talented people, and they said, essentially, go work on things that are of interest to you. There was a certain amount of direction towards the needs of the company, but Alexander Graham Bell felt very strongly that you give people freedom mm-hmm. on things. And so their developments in computer science were tremendous. And similarly, in the area of statistics, they came up with a lot of developments there. So one of the people in that group, or the group in statistical research, had formulated a computing system for statistics, and there was ongoing battles between the technical people and the administrative people, and so one of the technical people one time discovered that you cannot trademark a single letter name.
Cannot this trademark what?
A name that consists of one letter.
Oh.
So that was how the C programming language, and before that the B programming language. This was done just to irritate the lawyers because they wouldn't be able to trademark it. And so the language that was used in statistics was called S.
Oh.
And there was a commercial offshoot. You know, early on, there were four or five universities that became beta test sites for this. This was in the times when Bell Labs could not market software. They were a regulated monopoly, and mm-hmm. they couldn't get into the software business. And, you know, the Unix operating system was another example of this. But, you know, we had this agreement whereby we were test sites for it. You know, they were just trying to... And one of those groups was at the University of Washington in Seattle, and they ended up creating an offshoot company that marketed the software, so they purchased a license for the software from Bell Labs. And then in the early 1990s, two people at the University of Auckland, his names were are Rossi Haka and Robert Gentleman, they started to re-implement the language. So in the free software world, you know, the sort of Linux operating system and so forth, it's important that you write it afresh. You can't take the existing copyrighted software, but you can take the ideas. You can re-implement it. And they began a re-implementation, and because their names are Ross and Robert, they called it R rather than going from S to T or something like that. And around about 1995, I had been working with the people developing S, and I'd actually written part of it. And around about 1995, I started to get interested in that, and I had the opportunity to go on sabbatical, and I went to Australia, but along the way, I stopped and talked with the people in New Zealand, and became interested in this, and eventually, the whole project was housed in the computer that was sitting beside my desk for a long time. But this was one of these curious instances. I'd met Ross. I did not ever meet Robert. And it ended up that there was about 15 or 16 of us working on this project from all over the world. Mm-hmm. We'd never been in the same room. We were working on it for 3 or 4 years, and finally, by I think it was 1999, we finally all got together. It happened to be in Vienna, Austria. But this has now taken off beyond anything we could ever have expected. And it's now the sort of preferred system for statistics research. It's used in many, many different fields. There's it's suggested that the number of users is in the millions. And
really?
Essentially, we only use this system for the most part in our courses and in our research in the statistics department, and that's true around the world to a large extent. It's had a tremendous, and in January of this year, I was quite pleasantly surprised. I opened up the New York Times in the morning and got to the business section, and on the front page of the business section there was an article written about R. And I hadn't known it was in the works. They hadn't told us, but they did interview the two people, the R&R of the Ross and Robert, and they interviewed John Chambers, who was the person at Bell Labs who started off with the S language. I guess that there was some kind of an embargo, so they hadn't told us about this. But, you know, to have this project that just sort of started with people, you know, kind of in academia writing some computer code, mm-hmm. and, you know, be able to make it into the New York Times like that was quite amazing. So it's really taken on a life of its own, and that's really, you know, partially it's the development of the software. And people wonder, well, you know, you make this software available free. You know, anyone can download it, anyone can install it, and so on. Why isn't it sold? But in some ways, the purpose of the project is for us to have a platform on which we can carry out our own research. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't want to, every time I'm trying to implement a technique, to have to go back and recreate all of the data manipulation,
right.
all of the graphics, all of this and that. And essentially, this provides the mechanism, and because of the way that the free software is licensed, we're able to say, you know, anyone else can use this, but if they're going to enhance it, then they have to give back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't just take it and go off and, you know, create your own, sort of walk away with it but not share. So it's a very, very interesting culture and a very, to me, very rewarding activity that we can make this available and people can use it and then they contribute back and provide the support and so forth. And it's also been, for me, a wonderful way to contact people. And, you know, I've had researchers just contact me out of the blue and say, would you like to come here and teach a short course
mm-hmm.
on how to use, you know, the software that I have that's specific for certain kinds of analyses? And, you know, it's wonderful. I get to travel around the world. I get to meet interesting people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't feel, it's also a very interesting economy. Because, especially with the networking facilities that are available now, the cost of developing software is the cost of the first copy. Subsequent copies are essentially free.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once you've got it packaged for one user, you get it packaged for essentially everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of distribution, it doesn't matter whether there's one user or a million users,
mm-hmm.
you know, to a large extent. I mean, there's some overhead, but very little, really. And I love the fact that for the university here, they would consider that, you know, my developing that first copy is a legitimate research endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
There is the spirit of openness, the famous statement about the endless sifting and winnowing, mm-hmm. and all of that. So the university is very much in tune with this idea that it's going to be open, it's going to be transparent, and they'll be supportive.
Mm-hmm.
It's not true universally. There's places, well, the University of Auckland was where this would start, and then when it became popular, they wanted to commercialize it.
Mm-hmm.
I've never had any indications of anything like that from this university. And it's sort of, once the genie's out of the bottle, you can't put it back in.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't work out that way in any case. But I very much appreciate the atmosphere under which we can say, okay, we'll just develop this openly, and people can follow along what you're doing. I think that is even going to extend into our communications in terms of publication. There's a lot of online electronic journals now. I think that as electronic books become more popular, and certainly things are going in that direction, that you'll begin to see textbooks that people will be downloading perhaps rather than going through the traditional commercial
mm-hmm.
Aspects to it. But it is very well developed in terms of the software technology, and we've just been tremendously pleased that this project has taken off beyond.
Doug, is that project one of the reasons that the department's reputation is still so good?
It's not really focused in the department,
but I think the department.
I think that helps.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, people know that there's, some of the development has gone on here, and it,
mm-hmm.
Was housed here for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But in some ways, the project sort of exists beyond geography.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Said one time, it's like the sun never sets on the British Empire, and
mm-hmm.
We have people from all over the world. Last summer we have conferences now specifically on this software, and
oh really?
Yeah, last summer we had 500 people at a conference in Rennes, France, and the summer before that in Iowa City, Ames, Iowa, and before that in Dortmund, and we've met in Vienna and so forth. So every year it's gotten more and more people at it, and we're now at the point where it's a reasonably large conference, which is, again, astonishing that
this thing just was
created without a formal organization. There is something now called our foundation, but that came after the software. It just sort of sprung up because of the shared need
mm-hmm.
and the willingness to share the development on it. So it's been a remarkable.
How long have you been working on this, did you say?
Since 1995.
Mm-hmm.
But I was working on the language before then.
Mm-hmm.
But I made an application for a sabbatical, and 1996 was when I was on the sabbatical. But the application, of course, would have been written early in 1994, 1995, around then. And I said at the time that I thought that this open source software could be very useful in the teaching aspects as well as in the research aspects, and that was part of the purpose of my sabbatical, was to develop some of the teaching aspects of it. And it's one of the few occasions where things have gotten much better than I ever, in my most optimistic scenarios could have pictured in terms
mm-hmm.
of the application. So it's been tremendously rewarding
mm-hmm.
to be part of that. It can also be frustrating. There's always positive and negative aspects. I now am fielding questions from all around the world and sort of feel at times like I'm trapped.
Trapped at the email desk.
Yes, right, trapped at the email desk. Well, it's the same with the teaching now. Not surprisingly, make heavy use of the computer mediated facilities, and for several years I've transferred courses onto presentations that are using the projectors, and that's wonderful. I can walk around campus and go into different rooms and just plug in a computer and start a presentation, and I use the facilities that are provided here at the campus for what's called a course management system.
Mm-hmm.
So students don't have to carry around paper for their assignments anymore. They can just submit a file electronically, and for some bizarre reason, I say, well, it's Friday, but that means until 11:59 p.m. Well, then there's the expectation that somehow I'm going to be responding to questions at 11:30 p.m. on Friday. I remember being at an airport and seeing a big billboard about you can take your office anywhere now with this. It was one of the cell phone carriers, and I thought that may not be necessarily a good thing.
I'm amazed, Doug, when we go to the beach, the number of people sitting there with their laptops and cell phones, which seems to me almost pollution in a way.
Yes. So we have these wonderful facilities for communicating with other researchers, for communicating with our students, but some of the time that can mean never getting away from that.
This now concludes the second portion of the October 5th, 2009 interview with Professor Doug Bates of the Department of Statistics.